You know, there are certain laws of physics that we just, we accept as absolute, like gravity.
Right,
You
exactly.
hold an apple out, you let go, it falls to the ground
Yeah.
every single time. And if you want to lift that apple back up against gravity, it costs energy.
You have to do the work.
Yeah, you have to do the work. And in the financial world, there is an equivalent law of gravity. It's this underlying assumption that is baked into every single model, every textbook, and literally every Wall Street projection.
Right.
And it is simply this growth costs money. If a business wants to get bigger, if it wants to increase its profits, it has to spend capital to do it. It's just an undeniable, inescapable trade-off.
I mean, that really is the fundamental friction of the corporate universe.
Yeah.
You know, to build a new manufacturing plant or to hire 1,000 software engineers for a new product line.
Require a competitor, yeah.
Exactly. You have to burn fuel, you have to
Ooh.
take cash that could have gone straight to the owners today, and you spend it to secure growth for tomorrow.
But today, we're going to look at a concept that basically discovers like financial anti-gravity. We're going to explore a framework that literally breaks Wall Street spreadsheets.
It really does. It shatters them.
We are going completely off the map here to shatter the traditional rules of investing. And all of this incredible insight comes directly from a text known as the Averaging Up Collection.
Yeah, from averagingup.com.
Right, exactly. So our mission for this deep dive is to answer the single most timeless question in investing: what should you pay for growth?
And it's a phenomenal collection of text because it forces, like, a complete rewiring of how you evaluate a business.
Totally.
Because for decades, the greatest financial minds have argued endlessly over whether growth is a risk to be avoided or if it's a premium feature that you should happily pay up for.
Right.
But today's source material introduces this reality where growth isn't just free, it actually pays you to hold it.
Pays you, which is completely wild.
Yeah, it's totally counterintuitive.
But before we get to the really mind-bending part, we need to establish the baseline. We need to understand how investors have historically looked at this so you can see exactly how radical this new framework really is.
Oh, for sure.
The source text breaks this down into generations of thought, specifically focusing on the cost of the B, which is just a shorthand way of saying the growth engine of a business. Let's walk through these three classic answers.
Okay, well, let's start with the first generation, which belongs to Benjamin Graham. He's known as the godfather of value investing.
Right.
Graham looked at growth and essentially said, "Do not pay for it." His reasoning was that growth is inherently uncertain.
Because it requires humans.
Exactly. It requires capital, human decision-making, flawless execution, and humans make mistakes. Growth can fail.
Yeah.
So his answer was to buy the tangible asset, you know, the liquidation value, the hard floor of the business, and treat any future growth as a free bonus that you simply refuse to pay for. The price of growth, according to Graham, should just be zero.
So Graham is basically like buying a used car purely for the scrap metal value.
Right,
You know
exactly.
exactly what the metal is worth today. You put the key in and the car actually turns on and drives. Hey, that's a fantastic bonus.
But you didn't pay for the engine.
Right. You absolutely did not pay for the engine.
That analogy perfectly captures the extreme margin of safety Graham demanded. Then comes the second generation, Philip Fisher.
Okay.
Fisher looked at the world completely differently. He argued that you should pay for growth and you should actually pay generously for it.
Why is that?
Because if a business can retain a dollar of profit and reinvest it internally at, say, a 20% return, that compounding effect over a decade is magical.
Yeah.
To Fisher, the growth, the B is everything.
Okay,
But
right.
here is the critical catch, and this is important. Even for Fisher, the growth required massive amounts of capital. He was buying companies like Motorola and Texas Instruments in their early days.
Oh, right, heavy manufacturing.
Yeah, building physical radios and semiconductor fabrication plants takes mountains of cash. The growth was very real and very profitable, but it was incredibly expensive to generate.
So, sticking with the analogy, Fisher is basically buying an incredibly expensive racehorse.
Yes.
You're paying an absolute fortune up front, but you do it willingly because you know this horse is going to win major races and generate massive prize money over its lifetime.
Right. It's an expensive engine, but a powerful one.
Got it.
Which brings us to the third generation. And this is the synthesis of those two extremes, Peter Lynch and Warren Buffett. They popularize what we call GARP, which stands for growth at a reasonable price.
Okay, sure, RP.
Yeah. They argue that you shouldn't just ignore the growth like Graham, but you also shouldn't blindly overpay for it like Fisher. You find businesses where the growth justifies the price tag.
Right.
This is where you get metrics like the PEG ratio, where you're literally dividing the price to earnings ratio by the expected growth rate, trying to find that perfect mathematical balance. You want a reasonable price for a reasonable amount of growth.
So Buffett is buying the champion racehorse, but he's standing in the paddock haggling over the price to make sure he gets a fair deal.
Exactly. He wants the growth, but he wants it on his terms.
Okay, that makes sense.
But here is the massive, unquestioned assumption that all three of these generations share, which the Averaging Up collection brilliantly exposes.
The blind spot.
Yes.
Yes.
They all assume that growth has a positive cost. They all operate in a world where the business itself must burn fuel to grow.
Right, the gravity we talked about earlier.
Exactly. Whether you're Graham paying zero for it, Fisher paying a premium for it, or Buffett paying a reasonable price for it, you are still dealing with a machine that consumes capital to move forward.
Okay, let's unpack this, because this is where we cross the threshold in the deep dive. How on earth can the cost of growth drop below zero?
It sounds impossible.
I have to play the skeptic here, you know. Let's take Visa, which the text uses as its prime example. You say Visa's growth doesn't cost anything, but Visa still has to pay thousands of software engineers. They have to maintain massive data centers. They have to constantly fight global cybersecurity threats. How can the internal cost of that growth actually be zero when they clearly have all those expenses?
That is the perfect distinction to make, and it really comes down to the difference between maintenance capital and growth capital.
Okay, maintenance versus growth.
Yes. Visa has to pay its engineers and run its servers just to keep the lights on and process today's transactions. That's an operating expense. That is the cost of maintaining their current size.
Got it.
But the text introduces a fourth generation of thought called the free surfer. And for a free surfer, the capital required to actually expand the business to grow the pie is zero.
Wait, really? Zero?
Zero. Visa's growth doesn't come from them building new factories. It comes from an external structural wave. Visa does not pay to digitize the global economy.
Oh, I see.
Governments, massive commercial banks, and tech hardware companies are the ones spending billions to make the world cashless. Visa simply sits there and collects a toll on that wave. The wave pushes, the toll collects. The expansion is funded by someone else entirely.
So it's basically the difference between a motorboat and a sailboat.
Oh, that's a great way to look at it.
Yeah, a traditional business, like a motorboat, has to burn expensive gas every time it wants to go faster. The faster it goes, the more fuel it consumes. But a free surfer is a sailboat.
Right.
You still have to pay to maintain the boat, you know, patching the sails, fixing the rudder, which is what Visa's operating expenses are. But the actual forward momentum, the wind pushing the boat faster, that is completely external. That wind is free.
That perfectly illustrates the mechanism. The growth requires no internal fuel. So that is growth at no price.
Wow.
But the source material doesn't stop there. It introduces a fifth generation. The absolute climax of this framework. The cost of growth isn't just zero. It is mathematically negative.
Okay, we have to ground this in the numbers provided in the text, because otherwise it just sounds like a magic trick.
Yeah, let's look at the math.
The source uses the arithmetic of Visa looking ahead to the spring of 2026. So imagine you own shares of Visa. It generates roughly $19 in free cash flow per share.
Right.
And just to be clear, free cash flow is the actual cash left over after the business has paid all its bills and made all the investments needed to maintain itself.
The true surplus.
Exactly. Now, the growth rate of that free cash flow is roughly 12 to 15% a year. What does it cost Visa in new capital to generate that 12 to 15% growth? Zero. The world is going digital on its own dime.
And what's really fascinating here is what happens to that $19 of cash.
Yeah.
If the story ended with zero reinvestment, it would just be free growth.
Which is already great.
Right. But the story continues. Because Visa literally has no use for that cash to fund its own growth, it simultaneously returns approximately 4% to you, the shareholder. That's made up of roughly a 3% buyback yield, where they buy their own stock to increase your ownership share, plus 8.7% dividend yield paid straight to your pocket.
And this is the massive light bulb moment. This cash return is not a trade-off.
Not at all.
They aren't looking at a spreadsheet and deciding to sacrifice some growth in order to pay you a dividend. The growth consumes nothing. The entire free cash flow is a massive surplus.
Exactly.
So let's look at the net costs here. For every $100 of Visa you own, you get roughly $13 in free cash flow growth. The cost to generate that $13 was zero.
Right.
But on top of that, you are paid $4 in cash returns. So your net cost for the growth engine, the B, is negative $4. You are literally being paid $4 to receive $13 of growth.
It completely shatters that fundamental law of financial gravity we talked about at the beginning. You receive the growth, and you receive cold, hard cash for receiving it. The business is paying you to hold the growth.
Okay, let me push back on this though, because I know what you listening right now are probably thinking while looking at your portfolio.
Okay, let's hear it.
Let's look at the actual stock market. Visa is not a cheap stock. It traditionally trades at a very high valuation, say a price to earnings ratio of 35.
Sure.
If I am paying a PE of 35, aren't I massively overpaying? Doesn't a sky-high stock price completely ruin this negative cost magic? Isn't this just GARP growth at a reasonable price all over again, just with a really expensive stock?
That is the most common point of confusion, and the text explicitly separates the two. This is absolutely not JARPIA.
Okay, why not?
They operate on two entirely different axes. JARPIA is a conversation between you and the market. It asks, what is the stock market charging me to buy these shares today? It's a multiple fare. That is an external conversation about the stock price.
Right.
The negative cost to B, however, is about the internal physics of the business itself. It has nothing to do with what the market charges you to buy the stock. It is strictly about what the business has to spend internally to produce its growth.
Oh, I get it. So, to bring it back to Buffett, he buys a great traditional company for Berkshire Hathaway at a totally reasonable price. GRP is satisfied.
Exactly.
The stock market gave him a fair deal. But internally, that company still has to spend billions of dollars on new equipment or acquisitions to achieve its growth. The internal cost of growth is highly positive, regardless of what stock price Buffett paid.
Precisely the distinction. You can have a totally fair market price, but a positive internal cost of growth.
Yeah.
With a free surfer, you have a negative internal cost of growth at NIY market price. Even if Visa is trading at a PE of 35 or 40, the internal physics of the sailboat do not change.
Yeah.
The wind is still pushing for free, and the surplus cash is still overflowing out of the business and straight into your pockets.
I want to dig into that concept of the overflow because
Yeah.
the averaging up collection goes deep into the actual physics of this loop. In a normal mechanical business, there is this classic finance concept called the 15-15 rule.
Right, the 15-15 rule.
The business earns a 15% return on its equity. It retains all of those earnings and it reinvests them back into the business to generate 15% growth for the next year.
It is a perfectly closed loop. The business generates fuel, and the business consumes fuel. The retained earnings are the fuel.
Yeah.
If you remove the fuel, like if management decides to stop reinvesting and pay a dividend instead, the growth mathematically stops. That trade-off is how every single finance textbook describes compounding.
But the free surfer breaks the loop.
Yeah.
The growth doesn't need fuel because the external wave provides it.
Right.
So those retained earnings just pile up in the corporate bank account. They accumulate infinitely faster than the business can possibly deploy them because there is literally nothing to deploy them on. And so by sheer force of physics, the surplus has to overflow back to you, the owner, in the form of buybacks and dividends.
In the mechanical world, you have to choose, do I want the business to compound and get bigger, or do I want cash returned to me today? You cannot have both because the same dollar of fuel can only do one job. In the free surfer world, the fuel isn't needed for propulsion. So the fuel becomes surplus and the surplus becomes your payment. You get the growth, A and D, you get the fuel, both.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because the text introduces this concept called the compression amplifier.
Oh, this is my favorite part.
Right. We established that a high PE ratio doesn't break the internal physics.
Oh.
But wait, what happens during what analysts call PE compression? Like, when the broader stock market gets scared, macro conditions look bad and the stock gets much cheaper.
Right, a market dip.
Let's walk through the math on this. If the market is valuing the stock at a PE of 35, we noted my buyback yield is roughly 2.5%, and I am getting 12 to 15% free growth. My negative cost is that 2.5% payment.
Correct.
But if the market panics and the PE drops down to 28, the internal physics haven't changed. The growth is still 15% and free. But because the stock price is lower, the company's massive pile of surplus cash is buying back, oh wow, it's buying back a much larger percentage of the outstanding shares. My yield just went up.
You see the math perfectly. Your buyback yield just rose to approximately 3.5%. the negative cost just became even more negative. You're literally being paid more cash to receive the exact same free growth.
And if the market really panics, if there's a huge crash and the PE drops down to 22, that same fixed pile of surplus cash is buying back stock at bargain basement prices. The buyback yield would hit around 4.5%.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it reveals a beautiful irony. The less the market charges you for the stock, the more the business pays you to hold the growth.
That is wild.
Yeah, PE compression and the negative cost of B compound together. They are two forces pushing in the exact same direction.
That completely flips how you view market volatility. Like, traditional investors are terrified of a dropping PE ratio because it destroys their portfolio value.
Right, they panic.
But a free surfer investor, they should actively welcome it. The compression amplifier is just turning up the volume on the cash being shoveled into their pockets. Buying during a dip doesn't just mean getting growth at a discount. It means buying a payment stream that mathematically increases as the discount gets deeper.
This raises an important question, though. I mean, if this business model is structurally superior, and if the math is this undeniable, why hasn't traditional Wall Street caught on? Why aren't businesses with a negative cost of growth valued at PE ratios of 100 or more?
Because that is the massive elephant in the room. If this is so obvious, why hasn't the smartest money in the world priced this in completely?
It comes down to the fundamental tools the financial industry uses to measure value. Specifically, the discounted cash flow model, or DCF.
Ah, the DCF.
It is the absolute holy grail of Wall Street. Every analyst, every hedge fund, every investment bank uses some variation of it. But the DCF model has a fatal structural flaw when it encounters a free surfer.
Let's visualize this because I want to make sure I'm picturing exactly what an analyst sees. If I'm a Wall Street analyst sitting in a cubicle, I have my Excel spreadsheet open.
Right.
I'm looking at cell C4, which represents my growth projection. And right below it, I have cell C5, which is capital expenditures, the money the business has to spend.
Right.
The formula hard-coded into that spreadsheet literally will not let me increase cell C4 without automatically forcing cell C5 to go up as well. They are mathematically tethered together.
The software forces the trade-off. It assumes gravity exists. It assumes more growth requires more reinvestment, which by definition means less cash is left over to be returned to the owner.
Yeah.
The sum is mathematically constrained by the formula. But in a free surfer, growth, reinvestment, and cash return are entirely independent variables. Mm-hmm. The growth is 15%. The reinvestment is zero. The cash return is maximized.
The spreadsheet physically cannot reconcile those three numbers.
Yeah.
It tries to force a connection between variables that are fundamentally disconnected in the real world.
Exactly. The dominant financial models of the world, these spreadsheets running trillions of dollars of capital allocation, are structurally incapable of pricing a negative cost of growth.
Whoa.
They assume growth is a dependent variable tied to capital expenditure. When growth is exogenous, when it arrives uninvited from a structural wave like global digitization, the entire mental model falls apart.
So what does this all mean? It means Wall Street has a permanent blind spot. Because they are staring at a flawed map, they fundamentally misprice the territory. They will always undervalue these companies because their tools cannot compute a machine that prints cash and grows simultaneously without burning fuel.
It's a structural inefficiency.
Let's recap this epic journey we've just been on. We started down on Benjamin Graham's floor, where growth was something to be highly suspicious of, something you paid strictly zero for because human error could ruin it. We moved out to Philip Fisher's horizon, where growth was glorious, compounding at 20%, but fiercely expensive in terms of capital. We visited Warren Buffett's JARP, haggling in the paddock for a reasonable price on that growth engine.
The classic progression.
And finally, thanks to the insights from the Average and Up collection, we arrived at the absolute climax of the framework growth that literally pays you. The traditional 15-15 loop is broken. You don't have to choose between compounding your capital and receiving cash today. You get the wave, you get the fuel, and you get the cash at every single market price.
Yeah.
And thanks to the compression amplifier, if the stock price drops, you just get paid more.
It is a stunning realization when it finally clicks, and it leaves us with something critical to mull over.
What's that?
Well, if the standard DCF spreadsheet, the primary tool driving modern global finance, is fundamentally broken when it comes to these free surfer businesses because it forces a trade-off that doesn't actually exist, what other impossible business models are traditional spreadsheets completely mispricing right now? What other blind spots are just sitting there in the public markets, waiting for an investor to look past the hard-coded formula and see the actual physics of the business.
That is a brilliant question to end on. If you ever find yourself just accepting the models and spreadsheets that everyone else is using, remember that sometimes if you look closely enough at the mechanics, you might just find a place where gravity actually pushes you up. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into the Averaging Up collection. Keep questioning the formulas everyone else takes for granted, and we'll catch you next time.